foot was a squared-off aluminum band instead of something that looked human. Oliver Wendell Tyler found it easier to walk on, but his hand was completely normal, if rather large. He grabbed Ryan's and squeezed. "Welcome home, buddy." "How's it going, Skip?" Jack disengaged his hand from the grip of a former offensive tackle and mentally counted his fingers. Skip Tyler was a close friend who never fully appreciated his strength. "Good. Hi, Kathy." His wife got a kiss. "And how's Sally?" "Fine." She held up her arms and got herself picked up as desired. Only briefly, though. Sally wriggled free to get back to the luggage cart. "What are you doing here?" Jack asked. "Oh, Kathy must have called." "Don't worry about the car," Dr. Tyler said. "Jean and I retrieved it for you and dropped it off home. We decided we'd pick you up in ours. More room. She's getting it now." "Taking a day off, huh?" "Something like that." "Hell, Jack, Billings has been covering your classes for a couple of weeks. Why can't I take an afternoon off?" A skycap approached them, but Tyler waved him off. "How's Jean?" Kathy asked.
6 more weeks."
"It'll be a little longer for us," Kathy announced.
"Really?"
Tyler's face lit up.
"Outstanding!"
It was cool with a bright autumn sun as they left the terminal. Jean Tyler was already pulling up with the Tyler family's full-size Chevy wagon. Dark-haired, tall and willowy, Jean was pregnant with their 3rd and 4th children. The sonogram had confirmed the twins right before the Ryans had left for England. Her otherwise slender frame would have seemed grotesque with the bulge of the babies, except for the glow on her face. Kathy went right to her as she got out of the car and said something. Jack knew what it was immediately. Their wives immediately hugged. "Me too." Skip wrenched the tailgate open and tossed the luggage inside like so many sheets of paper.
"I gotta admire your timing, Jack. You made it back almost in time for Christmas break," Skip observed as everyone got in the car.
"I didn't exactly plan it that way," Jack objected.
"How's the shoulder?"
"Better than it was, guy."
"I believe it," Tyler laughed as he pulled away from the terminal.
"I was surprised they got you on the Concorde. How'd you like it?"
"It's over a lot faster."
"Yeah, that's what they say."
"How are things going at school?"
"Ah, oh, nothing ever changes."
"You heard about the game?"
Tyler's head came around.
"No, as a matter of fact."
"How did I ever forget about that?"
"Absolutely great. 5 points down, with 3 minutes left, we recover a fumble on our 12. Thompson finally gets it untracked and starts hitting sideline patterns. Boom, boom, boom. 8, 10 yards a pop. Then he pulls a draw play that gets us to the 30. Army changes its defense, right? So we go to a spread. I'm up in the press box, and I see their strong side safety is favoring the outside. Figures we gotta stop the clock, and we call a post for the tight end. Like a charm. Thompson couldn't have handed him the ball any better. 21-19. What a way to end the season."
Tyler was an Annapolis graduate who'd made second-string All-American at offensive tackle before entering the submarine service. 3 years before, when he'd been on the threshold of his own command, a drunk driver had left him without half his leg. Amazingly, Skip hadn't looked back. After taking his doctorate in engineering from MIT, he'd joined the faculty at Annapolis, where he was also able to scout and do a little coaching in the football program. Jack wondered how much happier Jean was now. A lovely girl who had once worked as a legal secretary, she must have resented Skip's enforced absences on submarine duty. Now she had him home. Surely he wasn't straying far. It seemed that Jean was always pregnant, and they were rarely separated. Even when they walked in the shopping malls, Skip and Jean held hands. If anyone found it humorous, he kept his peace about it.
"What are you doing about a Christmas tree, Jack?"
"I haven't thought about it," Ryan admitted. "I found a place where we can cut 'em fresh. I'm going over tomorrow. Want to come?"
"Sure."
"We have some shopping to do, too," he added quietly.
"Boy, you've really been out of it. Kathy called last week. Jean and I finished up the important part. Didn't she tell you? No. Ryan turned to see his wife smile at him.
Gotcha.
Thanks, Skip. Tyler waved his hand as they pulled onto the DC Beltway. We're going up to Jean's family's place. Last chance for her to travel before the twins arrive. And Professor Billings says you have a little work waiting for you. A little, Ryan thought. More like 2 months' worth. When are you going to be able to start back to work? It'll have to wait until he gets the cast off, Kathy answered for Jack. I'll be taking Jack to Baltimore tomorrow to see about that. We'll get Professor Holly to check him out.
No sense hurrying with that kind of injury, Skip acknowledged.
He had ample personal experience with that sort of thing. Robbie says hi. He couldn't make it. He's down at Pax River today on a flight simulator, learning to be an Airedale again. Rob and Sissy are doing fine. They were just over the house night before last. You picked a good weather day, too. Rained most of last week. Home, Jack told himself as he listened. Back to the mundane, day-to-day crap that grates on you so much, until somebody takes it away from you. It was so nice to be back to a situation where rain was a major annoyance, and one's day was marked by waking up, working, eating, and going back to bed. Catching things on television, and football games, the comics in the daily paper, helping his wife with the wash, curling up with a book and a glass of wine after Sally was put to bed. Jack promised himself that he'd never find this a dull existence again. He'd just spent over a month on the fast track, and was grateful that he'd left it 3,000 miles behind him.
Good evening, Mr. Cooley.
Kevin O'Donnell looked up from his menu.
Hello, Mr. Jameson. How nice to see you, the book dealer replied with well-acted surprise. Won't you join me?
Why, yes. Thank you.
What brings you into town?
Business. I'm staying overnight with friends at Cove.
This was true. It also told O'Donnell, known locally as Michael Jameson, that he had the latest message with him.
Care to look at the menu?
O'Donnell handed it over. Cooley inspected it briefly, closed it, and handed it back. No one could have seen the transfer. Jameson let the small envelope inside the folder drop to his lap. The conversation which ensued over the next hour drifted through various pleasantries. There were 4 Gardai in the next booth, and in any case Mr. Cooley did not concern himself with operational matters. His job was that of contact agent and cutout. A weak man, O'Donnell thought, though he'd never told this to anyone. Cooley didn't have the right qualities for real operations. He was better suited to the role of intelligence. Not that he'd ever asked, and surely the smaller man had passed through training well enough. His ideology was sound, but O'Donnell had always sensed within him a weakness of character that accompanied his cleverness. No matter. Cooley was a man with no record in any police station. He'd never even thrown a rock, much less a cocktail, at a Saracen. He'd preferred to watch and let his hate fester without an emotional release. Quiet, bookish, and unobtrusive, Dennis was perfect for his job. If Cooley was unable to shed blood, O'Donnell knew, he was also unlikely to shed tears.
You blonde little fellow. You can organize a superb intelligence-gathering operation, and so long as you don't have to do any of the wet work yourself, you can. You have helped cause the death of 10 or 12, wasn't it?
Did the man have any emotions at all? Probably not, the leader judged. Perfect. He had his own little Himmler, O'Donnell told himself. Or maybe Dzerzhinsky would be a more apt role model. Yes, Iron Felix Dzerzhinsky, that malignant, effective little man. It was only the round, puffy face that reminded him of the Nazi Himmler, and a man couldn't choose his looks, could he? Cooley had a future in the organization. When the time came, they'd need a real Dzerzhinsky.
They finished their talking over after-dinner coffee. Cooley picked up the check. He insisted. Business was excellent. O'Donnell pocketed the envelope and left the restaurant. He resisted the urge to read the report. Kevin was a man to whom patience came hard, and as a consequence he forced himself to it. Impatience had ruined more operations than the British Army ever had, he knew. Another lesson from his early days with the Provost. He drove his BMW through the old streets at the legal limit, leaving the town behind as he entered the narrow country roads to his home on the headlands. He did not take a direct route and kept an eye on his mirror. O'Donnell knew that his security was excellent. He also knew that continued vigilance was the reason it remained so. His expensive car was registered to his corporation's head office in Dundalk. It was a real business, with 9 blue water trawlers that dragged purse seine nets through the cold northern waters that surrounded the British Isles. The business had an excellent general manager, a man who had never been involved in the Troubles, and whose skills allowed O'Donnell to live the life of a country gentleman far to the south. The tradition of absentee ownership was an old one in Ireland. Like O'Donnell's home, a legacy from the English. It took just under an hour to reach the private driveway marked by a pair of stone pillars, and another 5 minutes to reach the house over the sea. Like any common man, O'Donnell parked his car in the open. The carriage house that was attached to the manor had been converted to offices by a local contractor. He went at once to his study. McKenny was waiting for him there, reading a recent edition of Yeats' poetry. Another bookish lad, though he did not share Cooley's aversion to the sight of blood. His quiet, disciplined demeanor concealed an explosive capacity for action. A man very like O'Donnell himself, Michael was. Like the O'Donnell of 10 or 12 years before, his youth needed tempering. Hence his assignment as chief of intelligence, so that he could learn the value of deliberation, of gathering all the information he could get before he committed himself to action. The provosts never really did that. They used tactical intelligence, but not the strategic kind. A fine explanation, O'Donnell thought, for the mindlessness of their overall strategy. Another of the reasons he had left the provisionals. But he would return to the fold. Or more properly, the fold would return to him. Then he would have his army. Kevin already had his plan, though not even his closest associates knew it. At least, not all of it. O'Donnell sat in the leather chair behind the desk and took the envelope from his coat pocket. McKenny discreetly went to the corner bar and got his superior a glass of whiskey. With ice, a taste Kevin had acquired in hotter climes several years before. He set the glass on the desk, and O'Donnell took it, sipping off a tiny bit without a word. There were 6 pages to the document, and O'Donnell read through the single-spaced pages as slowly and deliberately as McKenny had just been doing with the words of Yeats. The younger man marveled at the man's patience. For all his reputation as a fighter capable of ruthless action, the chief of the ULA often seemed a creature made of stone, the way he would assemble and process data. Like a computer, but a malignant one. He took fully 20 minutes to go through the 6 pages. "Well, our friend Ryan is back in America, where he belongs. Flew the Concorde home, and his wife arranged for a friend to meet them at the airport. Next Monday I expect he'll be back teaching those fine young men and women at their naval academy." O'Donnell smiled at the humor of his words. "His Highness and his lovely bride will be back home 2 days late. It seems that their aircraft developed electrical problems, and a new instrument had to be flown in all the way from England. Or so the public story will go. In reality, it would seem that they liked New Zealand so much that they wanted some additional time to enjoy their privacy. Security on their arrival will be impressive. In fact, looking this over, it would seem that their security for the next few months at least will be impenetrable." McKenny snorted. "No security is impenetrable. We've proven that ourselves." "Michael,
We do not wish to kill them. Any fool can do that, he said patiently. Our objective demands that we take them alive. But would they never learn? No buts, Michael. If I wanted to kill them, they would already be dead, and this Ryan bastard along with them. It is easy to kill, but that will not achieve what we wish.
Yes, sir.
McKinney nodded his submission. And Sean? They will be processing him in Brixton Prison for another 2 weeks or so. Our friends in C-13 don't want him far from their reach for the moment.
Does that mean that Sean...
Most unlikely, O'Donnell cut him off. Still and all, I think the organization is stronger with him than without him, don't you?
But how will we know?
There is a great deal of high-level interest in our comrade, O'Donnell half explained. McKinney nodded thoughtfully. He concealed his annoyance that the commander would not share his intelligence source with his own intelligence chief. McKinney knew how valuable the information was, but where it came from was the deepest of all the ULA's secrets. The younger man shrugged it off. He had his own information sources, and his skill at using their information was growing on a daily basis. Having always to wait so long to act on it chafed on him, but he admitted to himself, grudgingly at first, but with increasing conviction, that full preparation had allowed several tricky operations to go perfectly. Another operation that had not gone so well had landed him in the H-blocks of Longkesh Prison. The lesson he'd learned from this miscued op was that the revolution needed more competent hands. He'd come to hate the PIRA leadership's ineffectiveness even more than he did the British Army. The revolutionary often had more to fear from friends than enemies.
"Anything new with our colleagues?" O'Donnell asked.
"Yes, as a matter of fact," McKinney answered brightly. "Our colleagues were the provisional wing of the Irish Republican Army. One of the cells of the Belfast Brigade is going to go after a pub day after tomorrow. Some UVF chaps have been using it of late. Not very smart of them, is it?"
"I think we can let that one pass," O'Donnell judged. "It would be a bomb, of course, and it would kill a number of people, some of whom might be members of the Ulster Volunteer Force, whom he regarded as the reactionary forces of the ruling bourgeoisie, no more than thugs, since they lacked any ideology at all. So much the better that some UVF would be killed, but really any prod would suffice, since then other UVF gunmen would slink into a Catholic neighborhood and kill one or two people on the street. And the detectives of the RUC's Criminal Investigation Division would investigate, as always, and no one would admit to having seen much of anything, as usual, and the Catholic neighborhoods would retain their state of revolutionary instability. Hate was such a useful asset. Even more than fear, hate was what sustained the cause.
Anything else?"
"The bomb maker, Dwyer, has dropped out of sight again," McKinney went on.
"The last time that happened..."
"Yes.
England, wasn't it? Another campaign."
"Our man doesn't know. He's working on it, but I have told him to be careful."
"Very good."
O'Donnell would think about this one. Dwyer was one of the best PIRA bombers, a genius with delayed fuses, someone Scotland Yard's C-13 branch wanted as badly as they wanted anyone. Dwyer's capture would be a serious blow to the PIRA leadership.
"We want our chap to be very careful indeed, but it would be useful to know where Dwyer is."
McKinney got the message loud and clear. It was too bad about Dwyer, but that colleague had picked the wrong side.
"And the Belfast Brigadier?"
"No." The chief shook his head.
"But he'll slip away again. We needed a month to..."
"No, Michael. Timing. Remember the importance of timing. The operation is an integrated whole, not a mere collection of events." The commander of the PIRA's Belfast Brigade. Brigade. Less than 200 men, O'Donnell thought wryly,
was the most wanted man in Ulster. Wanted by more than one side, though for the moment the commander perforce had to let the Brits have him. Too bad. I will dearly love to make you pay personally for casting me out, Johnny Doyle, for putting a price on my head. But on this, I too must be patient. After all, I want more than your head. You might also keep in mind that our chaps have their own skins to protect. The reason timing is so important is that what we have planned can only work once. That is why we must be patient. We must wait for exactly the right moment. What right moment? What plan? McKinney wanted to know. Only weeks before, O'Donnell had announced that the moment was at hand, only to call things off with a last-second telephone call from London. Sean Miller knew, as did one or two others, but McKinney didn't even know who those privileged fellows were. If there was anything the commander believed in, it was security. The intelligence officer acknowledged its importance, but his youth chafed at the frustration of knowing the importance of what was happening without knowing what it was.
Difficult, isn't it, Mike?
Yes, sir.
It is, McKinney admitted with a smile.
Just keep in mind where impatience has gotten us, the leader said.
Chapter 8. Information.
I guess that about covers it, Jimmy. Thanks from the Bureau for tracking that guy down.
I really don't think he's the sort of tourist we need, Dan, Owens replied. A Floridian who'd embezzled $3 million from an Orlando bank had made the mistake of stopping off in Britain on his way to another European country, one with slightly different banking laws. I think the next time we'll let him do some shopping on Bond Street before we arrest him, though. You can call that a fee. A fee for apprehending him.
Huh. The FBI representative closed the last folder. It was 6 o'clock local time. Dan Murray leaned back in his chair. Behind him, the brick Georgian buildings across the street paled in the dusk. Men were discreetly patrolling the roofs there, as with all the buildings on Grosvenor Square. The American embassy was not so much heavily guarded as minorly fortified. So many terrorist threat warnings had come and gone over the past 6 years. Uniformed police officers stood in front of the building where North Audley Street was closed off to traffic. The sidewalk was decorated with concrete flower pots that a tank could surmount only with difficulty, and the rest of the building had a sloped concrete glacis to fend off car bombs. Inside, behind bullet-resistant glass, a Marine corporal stood guard beside a wall safe containing a .357 Magnum Smith & Wesson revolver. A hell of a thing, Murray thought. A hell of a thing. The wonderful world of the international terrorist. Murray hated working in a building that seemed part of the Maginot Line, hated wondering if there might be some Iranian, or Palestinian, or Libyan, or whatever madman of a terrorist with an RPG-7 rocket launcher in a building across the street from his office. It wasn't fear for his life. Murray had put his life at risk more than once. He hated the injustice, the insult to his profession, that there were people who would kill their fellow men as a part of some form of political expression. But they're not madmen at all, are they? The behavioral specialists say that they're not. They're romantics. Believers. People willing to commit themselves to an ideal and to commit any crime to further it. Romantics. Jimmy, remember the good old days when we hunted bank bandits who were just in the business for a fast buck? Well, I've never done any of those. Well, I was mainly concerned with ordinary thievery until they sent me to handling murders. But terrorism does make one nostalgic for the day of the common thug. I can even remember when they were fairly civilized. Owens refilled his glass with port. A growing problem for the Metropolitan Police was that the criminal use of firearms was no longer so rare as it had once been. This new tool made more popular by the evening news reports on terrorism within the UK. And while the streets and parks of London were far safer than their American counterparts, they were not as safe as they'd only recently been.
The times were changing in London, too, and Owens didn't like it at all. The phone rang. Murray's secretary had just left for the night, and the agent lifted it. Murray. Hi, Bob. Yeah, he's right here. Bob Hyland for you, Jimmy. He handed the phone over. Commander Owens here. The officer sipped at his port, then set the glass down abruptly and waved for a pen and pad. Where exactly? Then you've already... Good. Excellent. Well, I'm coming straight away. What gives? Murray asked quickly. We've just had a tip on a certain Dwyer. Bomb factory in a flat on Tooley Street. Isn't that right across the river from the tower? Too bloody right. I'm off. Owens rose and grabbed for his coat. You mind if I tag along? Dan, you must remember to keep out of the way. Murray was already on his feet. One hand unconsciously checked his left hip where his service revolver would be had the agent not been in a foreign country. Owens had never carried a gun. Murray wondered how you could be a cop and not be armed with something. Together they left Murray's office and trotted up the corridor, turning left for the elevators. 2 minutes later they were in the embassy's basement parking garage. The two officers from Owen's chase car were already in their vehicle, and the commander's driver followed them out. Owens was on the radio the instant the car hit the street, with Murray in the back seat.
You have people rolling? Murray asked.
Yes. Bob will have a team there in a few minutes. Dwyer, by God! The description fits perfectly.
As much as he tried to hide it, Owens was as excited as a kid on Christmas morning.
Who tipped you?
Anonymous. A male voice, claimed to have seen wiring, and something that was wrapped up in small blocks when he looked in the window.
I love it. Peeping Tom cues the cops. Probably afraid his wife'll find out what he's been up to.
Well, you take what you can get. Murray grinned. He'd had cases break on slimmer stuff than this. The evening traffic was curb to curb, and the police siren could not change that. It took fully 20 frustrating minutes to travel the 5 miles to Tooley Street, with Owens listening to the radio, his fist beating softly on the front door's armrest while his men arrived at the suspect house. Finally, the car darted across the tower bridge and turned right. The driver parked it on the sidewalk alongside two other police cars. It was a 3-story building of drab, dirty brick in a working-class neighborhood. Next door was a small pub with its daily menu scrawled on a blackboard. Several patrons were standing at the door, pints in their fists as they watched the police, and more stood across the street. Owens ran to the door. A plainclothes detective was waiting for him.
All secure, sir. We have the suspect in custody. Top floor in the rear.
The commander trotted up the stairs with Murray on his heels. Another detective met him on the top floor landing. Owens proceeded the last 30 feet with a cruel, satisfied smile on his face.
It's all over, sir, Hyland said. Here's the suspect.
Maureen Dwyer was stark naked, spread-eagled on the floor. Around her was a puddle of water and a trail of wet footprints coming from the adjacent bathroom.
She was taking a bath, Hyland explained, and she'd left her pistol on the kitchen table. No trouble at all.
Do you have a female detective on the way?
Yes, sir. I'm surprised she's not here already.
Traffic is bloody awful, Owens noted.
Any evidence of a companion?
No, sir. None at all, Hyland answered.
Only this.
The bottom drawer of the only bureau in the shabby apartment was lying on the floor. It contained several blocks of what looked like plastic explosive, some blasting caps, and what were probably electronic timers. Already a detective was doing a written inventory, while another was busily photographing the entire room with a Nikon camera and strobe. A third was breaking open an evidence kit. Everything in the room would be tagged, dropped in a clear plastic bag, and stored for use in yet another terrorist trial in the Old Bailey. There were smiles of satisfaction everywhere, except for Maureen Dwyer's face, which was pressed to the floor. Two detectives stood over the girl, their service revolvers holstered as they watched the naked, wet figure without a trace of sympathy. Murray stood in the doorway to keep out of everyone's way while his eyes took in the way Owen's detectives handled the scene. There wasn't much to criticize. The suspect was neutralized, the area secured, and now evidence was being collected. Everything was going by the book. He noted that the suspect was kept stationary. A woman officer would perform a cavity search to ensure that she wasn't holding something that might be dangerous. This was a little hard on Miss Dwyer's modesty, but Murray didn't think a judge would object. Maureen Dwyer was a known bomber, with at least 3 years' work behind her. 9 months before, she'd been seen leaving the site of a nasty one in Belfast that minutes later had killed 4 people and maimed another 3. No, there wouldn't be all that much sympathy for Miss Dwyer. After another several minutes, a detective took the sheet off the bed and draped it over her, covering her from her knees to her shoulders. Through it all, the suspect didn't move. She was breathing rapidly, but made no sound.
"This is interesting," one man said.
He pulled a suitcase from under the bed. After checking it for booby traps, he opened it and extracted a theatrical makeup case complete with 4 wigs.
"Goodness, I could use one of those myself."
The female detective squeezed past Murray and approached Owens.
"I came as fast as I could, Commander."
"Carry on."
Owens smiled. He was too happy to let something this minor annoy him.
"Spread 'em, dearie. You know the drill."
The detective put on a rubber glove for her search. Murray didn't watch. This was one thing he'd always been squeamish about. A few seconds later, the glove came off with a snapping sound. A detective handed Dwyer some clothes to put on. Murray watched the suspect dress herself as unselfconsciously as if she'd been alone. No, he thought. Alone, she'd show more emotion. As soon as her clothes were on, a police officer snapped steel handcuffs on her wrists. The same man informed Dwyer of her rights, not very differently from the way American cops did it. She did not acknowledge the words. Maureen Dwyer looked about at the police, no expression at all on her face, not even anger, and was taken out without having said a single word. "That's a cold piece of work," Murray told himself. Even with her hair wet, with no makeup, she was pretty enough, he thought. Nice complexion. It wouldn't hurt her to knock off 8 or 10 pounds, but in nice clothes that wouldn't matter very much. You could pass her on the street, or sit next to her in a bar and offer to buy her a drink, and you'd never suspect that she was carrying 2 pounds of high explosives in her purse. Thank God we don't have anything like that at home. He wondered how well the Bureau would do against such a threat. Even with all their resources, the scientific and forensic experts who back up the special agents in the field, this was no easy crime to deal with. For any police force, the name of the game was wait for the bad guys to make a mistake. You had to play for the breaks, just like a football team waited for a turnover. The problem was, the crooks kept getting better, kept learning from their mistakes. It was like any sort of competition. Both sides became increasingly sophisticated. But the criminals always had the initiative. The cops were always playing catch-up ball.
"Well, Dan, any critique? Do we measure up to FBI standards?"
Owens inquired with the slightest amount of smugness.
"Don't give me that crap, Jimmy,"
Murray grinned. Things were settled down now. The detectives were fully engaged in cataloging the physical evidence in the confidence that they already had a solid criminal case.
"I'd say you have this one pretty cold. You know how lucky you are not to have our illegal search and seizure rules. Not to mention some of our judges."
"Finished," the photographer said.
"Excellent," replied Sergeant Bob Hyland, who was running the crime scene. "How'd you get here so fast, Bob?"
Murray wanted to know.
"You take the tube or what?" "Why didn't I think of that?"
Hyland laughed.
"Perhaps we caught the traffic right. We were here within 11 minutes. You weren't that far behind us. We booted the door and had Dwyer in custody in under 5 seconds. Isn't it amazing how easy it can be, if you have the bloody information you need?" "Can I come in now?"
"Certainly." Owens waved him into the apartment. Murray went right to the bureau drawer with the explosives. The FBI man was an expert on explosive devices. He and Owens crouched over the collection.
"Looks like Czech," Murray muttered. "It is," another detective said. "From Skoda Works. You can tell from the wrapping.
These are American, though. California Pyrenetics, Model 31 electronic detonator. He tossed one in a plastic bag to Murray.
Damn, they're turning up all over the place. A shipment of these little babies got hijacked a year and a half ago.
They were heading for an oil field in Venezuela and got taken outside Caracas, Murray explained. He gave the small black device a closer look. The oil field guys love them. Safe, reliable, and damn near foolproof. This is as good as the stuff the Army uses. State of the art.
Where else have they turned up? Owens asked.
We're sure about three or four. The problem is they're so small that it's not always possible to identify what's left. A bank in Puerto Rico, a police station in Peru. Those were political. The other one, maybe two, were drug-related. Until now, they've all been on the other side of the Atlantic. As far as I know, this is the first time they've showed up here. These detonators have lot numbers. You'll want to check them against the stolen shipment. I can get a telex off tonight. Have you an answer inside an hour?
Thank you, Dan.
Murray counted 5 1-kilo blocks of explosive. The Czech plastique had a good reputation for quality. It was as potent as the stuff DuPont made for American military use. One block properly placed could take a building down. With the Pyrenetics timers, Ms. Dwyer could have placed 5 separate bombs, set them for delayed detonation, as much as a month, and been 1,000 miles away when they went off.
You saved some lives tonight, gentlemen. Good one.
Murray looked up. The apartment had a single window facing to the rear. The window had a pull-down blind that was all the way down, and some cheap, dirty curtains. Murray wondered what this flat cost to rent. Not much, he was sure. The heat was turned way up, and the room was getting stuffy.
Anybody mind if I let some air in here? Excellent idea, Dan, Owens answered. Let me do it, sir.
A detective with gloves on put up the blind and then the window. Everything in the room would be dusted for fingerprints also, but opening the window wouldn't harm anything. A breeze cooled things off in an instant.
That's better.
The FBI representative took a deep breath, scarcely noticing the smell of diesel exhaust from the London cabs. Something was wrong. It hit Murray as a surprise. Something was wrong.
What?
He looked out the window. To the left was probably a warehouse, a blank 4-story wall. Past it, on the right, he could see the outline of the Tower of London, standing over the River Thames. That was all. He turned his head to see Owens, also staring out the window. The commander of C-13 turned his head and looked at Murray, a question on his face also.
Yes, Owens said. What was it that guy on the phone said? Murray muttered.
Owen's head bobbed.
Exactly. Sergeant Hyland.
Yes, Commander.
The voice on the phone. What exactly did it say, and what exactly did it sound like?
Owens kept looking out the window.
The voice had a Midlands accent, I should think. A man's voice. He said that he was looking in the window and saw explosives and some wires. We have it all on tape, of course.
Murray reached through the open window and ran a finger along the outside surface of the glass. It came back dirty. It sure wasn't a window washer who called in. He leaned out the window. There was no fire escape.
Someone atop the warehouse, perhaps.
No, Owens said at once. The angle isn't right, unless she had the material spread out on the floor.
That is rather odd.
Break in? Maybe someone got in here, saw the stuff, and decided to call in like a good citizen? Murray asked.
That doesn't sound very likely.
Owens shrugged.
No telling, is there? A boyfriend she dumped?
I think for the moment we can be content with counting our blessings, Dan. There are 5 bombs that will never hurt anyone. Let's get out of everyone's way and send that telex off to Washington.
Sergeant Hyland, gentlemen, this was well done. Congratulations to you all for some splendid police work. Carry on.
Owens and Murray left the building quietly. Outside they found a small crowd being restrained by about 10 uniformed constables. A TV news crew was on the scene with its bright lights.
These were enough to keep them from seeing across the street. This block had three small pubs. In the doorway of one stood a soft-looking man with a pint of bitter in his hand. He showed no emotion, not even curiosity, as he looked across the street. His memory recorded the faces he saw. His name was Dennis Cooley. Murray and Owens drove to New Scotland Yard headquarters, where the FBI agent made his telex to Washington. They didn't discuss the one anomaly that the case had unexpectedly developed, and Murray left Owens to his work. C-13 had broken yet another bomb case, and done so in the best way, without a single casualty. It meant that Owens and his people would have a sleepless night of paperwork and preparing reports for the Home Office bureaucracy and press releases for Fleet Street. But that was something they would gladly accept. Ryan's first day back at work was easier than he had expected. His prolonged absence had forced the history department to reassign his classes, and in any case it was almost time for Christmas break, and nearly all of the mids were looking forward to being home for the holidays. Class routine was slightly relaxed, and even the plebes enjoyed a respite from the upperclassmen's harassment in the wake of the win over Army. For Ryan, the result was a fairish collection of letters and documents piled on his in-tray, and a quiet day with which to deal with them. He'd arrived in his office at 7:30. By 4:45 he'd dealt with most of his paperwork, and Ryan felt that he'd delivered an honest day's work. He was finishing a series of test questions for the semester's final exam when he smelled cheap cigar smoke and heard a familiar voice. "Did you enjoy your vacation, boy?" Lieutenant Commander Robert Jefferson Jackson was leaning against the doorframe. "It had a few interesting moments, Robbie. The sun over or under the yardarm yet?" "Damn straight," Jackson set his white cap on top of Ryan's filing cabinet and collapsed unceremoniously into the leather chair opposite his friend's desk. Ryan closed the file folder on his draft exam and shoved it into a desk drawer. One of the personal touches in his office was a small refrigerator. He opened it and took out a 2-liter bottle of 7-Up, along with an empty bottle of Canada Dry ginger ale, then removed a bottle of Irish whiskey from his desk. Robbie got 2 cups from the table by the door and handed them to Jack. Ryan mixed 2 drinks to the approximate color of ginger ale. It was against Academy policy to have liquor in one's office, a stance Ryan found curious given the naval orientation of the institution, but drinking ginger ale was a winked-upon subterfuge. Besides, everyone recognized that the officer and faculty club was only a minute's walk away. Jack handed 1 drink over and replaced everything but the empty ginger ale bottle. "Welcome home, pal," Robbie held his drink up. "Nice to be back." The 2 men clicked their cups together. "Glad you made it, Jack. You kind of worried us." "How's the arm?" Jackson gestured with his cup. "Better than it was. You ought to see the cast I started out with. They took it off at Hopkins last Friday. I learned 1 thing today, though. Driving a stick shift through Annapolis with 1 arm is a bitch." "I'll bet," Robbie chuckled. "Damn if you ain't crazy, boy." Ryan nodded agreement. He'd met Jackson the previous March at a faculty tea. Robbie wore the gold wings of a naval aviator. He'd been assigned to the nearby Patuxent River Naval Air Test Center, Maryland, as an instructor in the test pilot school, until a faulty relay had unexpectedly blasted him clear of the Buckeye jet trainer he'd been flying one fine clear morning. Unprepared for the event, he'd broken his leg badly. The injury had been serious enough to take him off flight status for 6 months, and the Navy had assigned him to temporary duty as an instructor in Annapolis, where he was currently in the engineering department. It was an assignment which Jackson regarded as 1 step above pulling oars in a galley. Jackson was shorter than Ryan, and much darker. He was the 4th son of a Baptist preacher in southern Alabama. When they'd first met, the officer was still in a cast, and Jackson had asked Ryan if he might want to try his hand at kendo. It was something that Ryan had never tried, the Japanese fencing sport in which bamboo staves are used in place of samurai swords. Ryan had used pugil sticks in the Marines and figured it wouldn't be too different. He'd accepted the invitation, thinking that his longer reach would be a decisive advantage, particularly on top of Jackson's reduced mobility. It hadn't occurred to him that Jackson would first have asked a brother officer for a kendo match. In fact, Ryan later learned, he had. He'd also learned by then that Robbie had the blinding quickness and killer instinct of a rattlesnake. By the time the bruises had faded, they were fast friends. For his part, Ryan had introduced the pilot to the smoky flavor of good Irish whiskey, and they'd evolved the tradition of an afternoon drink or two in the privacy of Jack's office. "Any news on campus?" Ryan asked.
"Still teaching the boys and girls," Jackson said comfortably.
"And you've started to like it?"
"Not exactly. The leg's finally back in Battery, though. I've been spending my weekends down at Pax River to prove I still know how to fly. You know, you made one hell of a flap hereabouts."
"When I was shot?"
"Yeah. I was in with the superintendent when the call came in. The soup put it on speaker, and we got this FBI guy asking if we got a nutcase teacher in London playing cops and robbers. I said, sure, I know the jerk, but they wanted somebody in the history department to back me up. Mainly, they wanted the name of your travel agent, I suppose. Anyway, everybody was out to lunch, and I had to track Professor Billings down in the O Club, and the superintendent did some running around, too. You almost ruined the boss's last golf day with the governor."
"Damn near ruined my day, too."
"Was it like they said in the papers?"
"Probably. The Brit papers got it pretty straight." Jackson nodded as he tapped the cigar on Ryan's ashtray.
"You're lucky you didn't come home parcel post, boy," he said.
"Don't you start, Robbie. One more guy tells me I'm a hero and I'll flatten him."
"Hero? Hell no. If all you honkies were that dumb, my ancestors would have imported yours."
The pilot shook his head emphatically.
"Didn't anybody ever tell you that hand-to-hand stuff is dangerous?"
"If you'd been there, I bet you'd have done the same."
"No chance. God almighty, is there anything dumber than a Marine? This hand-to-hand stuff, jeez, you get blood on your clothes, mess up the shine on your shoes. No way, boy. When I do my killing, it'll be with cannon shells and missiles. You know, the civilized way."
Jackson grinned.
"The safe way.
Not like flying an airplane that decides to blast you loose without warning you first," Ryan scoffed.
"I dinged my leg some, sure, but when I got my Tomcat strapped to my back, I'm humming along at 600-plus knots. Anybody who wants to put a bullet in me, fella, he can do it, but he's gonna have to work at it."
Ryan shook his head. He was hearing a safety lecture from someone who just happened to be in the most dangerous business there was, a carrier aviator and a test pilot.
"How's Kathy and Sally?" Robbie asked, more seriously.
"We meant to come over Sunday, but we had to drive up to Philadelphia on short notice.
It was kinda tough on them, but they came through all right."
"You got a family to worry about, Jack," Jackson pointed out. "Leave that rescue stuff to the professionals." The funny thing about Robbie, Jack knew, was his caution. For all the down-home bantering about his life as a fighter pilot, Jackson never took a risk he didn't have to. He'd known pilots who had. Many were dead. There was not a single man wearing those gold wings who had not lost a friend, and Jack wondered how deeply that had affected Jackson over the years. Of one thing he was sure, though Robbie was in a dangerous business, like all successful gamblers, he thought things over before he moved his chips. Wherever his body went, his mind had already gone. "It's all over, Rob. It's all behind me, and there won't be a next time."
"We'll put a big Roger on that. Who else am I going to drink with? So how'd you like it over there?"
"I didn't see very much, but Kathy had a great time, all things considered. I think she saw every castle in the country, plus the new friends we made."
"That must have been right interesting,"
Robbie chuckled. The flyer stubbed out his cigar. They were cheap, crooked, evil-smelling little things, and Jack figured that Jackson puffed on them only as part of the image of the fighter pilot. Not hard to understand why they took a liking to you. They took a liking to Sally, too. They got her started riding horses, Jack added sourly.
Oh, yeah? So what are they like?
You'd like 'em, Ryan assured him. Jackson smiled.
Yeah, I imagine I would. The prince used to drive phantoms, so he must be a right guy, and his dad's supposed to know his way around a cockpit, too. I hear you took the Concorde back. How'd you like it?
I meant to ask you about that. How come it was so noisy? I mean, if you're doing Mach 2 plus, why isn't all the noise behind you?
Jackson shook his head sadly. What's the airplane made out of?
Aluminum, I suppose.
You suppose the speed of sound is faster in metal than it is in air, maybe? Jackson asked.
Oh. The sound travels through the body of the airplane.
Sure. Engine noise. Noise from the fuel pumps, various other things.
Okay. Ryan filed that away.
You didn't like it, did you?
Robbie was amused at his friend's attitude toward flying.
Why does everybody pick on me for that? Ryan asked the ceiling. Because it's so funny, Jack. You're the last person in the world who's afraid to fly.
Hey, Rob, I do it, okay? I get aboard and strap in and do it.
I know. I'm sorry.
Jackson eased off. It's just that it's so easy to needle you on this.
I mean, what are friends for?
You done good, Jack. We're proud of you. But for Christ's sake, be careful, okay? This hero shit gets people killed.
I hear you.
Is it true about Kathy? Robbie asked.
Yep. The doc confirmed it the same day they took the cast off.
Way to go, Pop. I say that calls for another. A light one.
Robbie held his cup out, and Jack poured.
Looks like the bottle's about had it, too.
It's my turn to buy the next one, isn't it?
It's been so long, I don't remember, Robbie admitted. But I'll take your word for it.
So they have you back in airplanes?
Next Monday they'll let me back in the Tomcat, Jackson replied. And come summer, it's back to the work they pay me for.
You got orders?
Yeah. You're looking at the prospective XO of VF-41.
Robbie held his cup up in the air.
The executive officer of Fighter Squadron 41, Ryan translated.
That's all right, Rob.
Yeah? It's not bad, considering I've been a black shoe for the past 7 months.
Ride out on carriers?
No, we'll be on the beach for a while down at Oceana, Virginia. The squadron's deployed now on Nimitz. When the boat comes back for refit, the fighters stay on the beach for refresher training. Then we'll probably redeploy on Kennedy. They're reshuffling the squadron assignments.
Jack, it'll be good to strap that fighter back on. I've been here too long.
We're gonna miss you and Sissy.
Hey, we don't leave till summer. They're making me finish out the school year, and Virginia Beach isn't all that far away.
Come on down and visit, for crying out loud. You don't have to fly, Jack. You can drive, Jackson pointed out.
Well, you'll probably be around for the new kid.
Good.
Jackson finished off his drink.
Are you and Sissy going anywhere for Christmas?
Not that I know of.
I can't, really. Most of the holidays I'm going to be flying down at PAX.
Okay.
Come on over to our place for dinner. Three-ish.
Kathy's family isn't...
No, Ryan said as he tucked everything back where it belonged.
Robbie shook his head.
Some folks just don't catch on, the pilot observed.
Well, you know how it is. I don't worship at the temple of the almighty dollar anymore.
But you managed to do a job on the collection basket.
Jack grinned.
Yeah, you might say that.
That reminds me, there's a little outfit outside Boston that's gonna hit it big.
Oh?
Jack's ears perked up.
It's called Holoware Limited, I think. They came up with new software for the computers on fighter planes.
Really good stuff. Cuts a third off the processing time. Generates intercept solutions like magic. It's set up on the simulator down at PAX, and the Navy's gonna buy it real soon. Who knows? Jackson laughed as he got his things. The company doesn't know yet. Captain Stevens down at PAX just got the word from the guys out at Top Gun. Bill May out there, I used to fly with Bill, ran the stuff for the first time a month ago, and he liked it so much that he almost got the Pentagon boys to cut through all the bullshit and just buy the stuff. It got hung up, but DCNO Air is on it now, and they say Admiral Rendell is really hot for it. 30 more days, and that little company's gonna get a Christmas present. A little late, Robbie said, but it'll fill one big stocking. Just for the hell of it, I checked the paper this morning, and sure enough, they're listed on the American Exchange. You might want to check it out. What about you? The pilot shook his head. I don't play the market. But you still fool around there, right? A little. Is this classified or anything? Jack asked. Not that I know of. The classified part is how the software is written, and they got a real good classification system on that. Nobody understands it. Maybe Skip Tyler could figure it out, but I never will. You have to be a nook to think in ones and zeros. Pilots don't think digital. We're analog. Jackson chuckled. Gotta run. Sissy's got a recital tonight. Night, Rob. Low and slow, Jack. Robbie closed the door behind him. Jack leaned back in his chair for a moment. He smiled to himself, then rose and packed some papers into his briefcase. Yeah, he said to himself, just to show him that I still know how. Ryan got his coat on and left the building, walking downhill past the Preble Memorial. His car was parked on Decatur Road. Jack drove a 5-year-old VW Rabbit. It was a very practical car for the narrow streets of Annapolis, and he refused to have a Porsche like his wife used for commuting back and forth to Baltimore. It was dumb, he'd told Kathy about 1,000 times, for 2 people to have 3 cars. A Rabbit for him, a 911 for her, and a station wagon for the family. Dumb. Kathy's suggestion that he should sell the Rabbit and drive the wagon was, of course, unacceptable. The little gas engine fired up at once. It sounded too noisy. He'd have to check the muffler. Jack pulled out, turning right, as always, onto Maryland Avenue through Gate 3 in the grimly undecorous perimeter wall that surrounded the academy. A Marine guard saluted him on the way out. Ryan was surprised by that. They'd never done it before. Driving wasn't easy. When he shifted, Ryan twisted his left hand inside the sling to grab the wheel while his right hand worked the gear shift. The rush hour traffic didn't help. Several thousand state workers were disgorging themselves from various government buildings, and the crowded streets gave Ryan plenty of opportunity to stop and restart from first gear. His Rabbit had 5 plus reverse, and by the time he got to the Central Avenue light, he was asking himself why he hadn't gotten the Rabbit with an automatic. Fuel efficiency was the answer. Is this worth an extra 2 miles per gallon? Ryan laughed at himself as he headed east toward the Chesapeake Bay, then right onto Falcon's Nest Road. There was rarely any traffic back here. Falcon's Nest Road came to a dead end not too far down from Ryan's place, and on the other side of the road were several farms, also dormant at the beginning of winter. The stubby remains of corn stalks lay in rows on the brown, hard fields. He turned left into his driveway. Ryan had 30 acres on Peregrine Cliff. His nearest neighbor, an engineer named Art Palmer, was 1/2 mile away through heavily wooded slopes and across a murky stream. The cliffs on the western shore of the Chesapeake Bay were nearly 50 feet high where Jack lived. Those farther south got a little higher, but not much, and made of crumbly sandstone. They were a paleontologist's delight. Every so often a team from a local college or museum would scour at the base and find fossilized shark teeth that had once belonged to a creature as large as a midget submarine, along with the bones of even more unlikely creatures that had lived here 100 million years earlier. The bad news was that the cliffs were prone to erosion. His house was built 100 feet back from the edge,
and his daughter was under strict orders, twice enforced with a spanking, not to go anywhere near the edge. In an attempt to protect the cliff face, the state environmental protection people had persuaded Ryan and his neighbors to plant kudzu, a prolific